Welcome to the Free Will Show. I'm one of your hosts, Taylor Sear.
And I'm your other host, Matt Plummer. In this episode, we discuss the consequence argument, a powerful argument for incompatibilism. After we go through the argument, we talk more generally about what some people refer to as the problem of free will and determinism.
Our guest in this episode is Peter Van Inwagen. And as always, if you have any questions that you'd like us to address in our Q&A episode at the end of the season, feel free to get in touch with us via our website, thefreewillshow.com, or through social media at thefreewillshow.
Thanks for listening.
Enjoy. Well, I'm very happy to introduce our guest today. Our guest is Peter Van Inwagen. Peter is the John Cardinal O'Hara Professor of Philosophy Emeritus at the University of Notre Dame, as well as Research Professor of Philosophy at Duke University. He's the author of one of the most influential books ever written on the topic of free will, called An Essay on Free Will, published in 1983 by Oxford Clarendon Press. And more recently, he's published a collection of essays called Thinking About Free Will with Cambridge University Press, which came out in 2017. Thanks for joining us, Peter. Could you start by telling us and our audience a little bit about yourself, your work, and how you came to be interested in working on free will?
Well, sure. I don't know what you need to know about myself, but I'll tell you how I became interested in free will. In the 1960s, when I was a graduate student, let's go back to the year 1965, the first year I was a graduate student, and I was talking with another graduate student. He was much my superior because he was a second-year graduate student, and I was just a graduate student. But we'd been undergraduates together. We knew each other. We were old friends. And I said something that presupposed that you couldn't both have free will and be in a world in which the past determined the future. And he sort of poo-pooed that. He said, well, everybody knows that's not right. And indeed, that was the common view at the time and had been in certain circles for hundreds of years, particularly in the English-speaking countries. Thomas Hobbes, David Hume, John Stuart Mill, and a whole host of lesser-known philosophers had all said you could have both free will and determinism. Determinism being the thesis that the past determines the future. And so I said, that doesn't sound right to me because, look, if determinism is true, then you've got all these laws of physics and you've got the past, and the laws of physics say there's only one way the past can evolve or develop with time. There's only one possible future. So look, if I had the ability to do something I'm not going to do, for instance, if I was trying to decide whether to lie or to tell the truth on some occasion, and suppose I decide to lie, well, was I able to tell the truth? That's what free will means, right? That is, you have a decision to make and you're able to do both things. Or looking back on it, you did the one thing, but you were able to do the other. Well, I mean, if you have determinism, that would mean if I was able to do the other thing, then either the past would have had to be different or the laws of physics would have to be different. And that would mean, wouldn't it, if I was able, say, to tell the truth when I actually told a lie, being able to tell the truth would mean I was either able to change the past or I was able to change the laws of physics. Well, you can't do either one of those things. So I don't see how all these philosophers who say that free will and determinism can both be true. I don't see how that can be right. So that was the genesis of the consequence argument. In my mind, I mean, other people had said similar things. There were a lot of philosophers like Roderick Chisholm and James Lamb and Carl Genet at the time who had advanced similar arguments. I invented the term, the consequence argument, but the argument itself was devised in various forms by various philosophers. I think I framed it in a way that made it more accessible to a lot of people. But it's by no means, it's only the name really that's original with me. Okay.
Yeah.
That's my answer to your first question.
Yeah. So you gave us a really nice explanation of what you take determinism to be. Are there any other concepts or terms that would be important for a listener to understand in order to understand the consequence argument in more detail?
Well, it depends what you mean in more detail.
See, of course.
You're talking about, there's two theses. That we have free will is one of them, and that the past determines the future. That's called determinism. The other is called, well, I call it the free will thesis. Now, the free will thesis is a thesis about human actions, right? It's about what you can and can't do, or what you're able to do and what you're not able to do. And the determinism is essentially a thesis about statements or propositions. That is, it tells you that if you take the propositions or statements that are the laws of physics, and you take a statement that describes the world as it was in the past, complete description of it, then you can logically deduce from the statement about the past and the laws of physics together any statement. Any statement, whatever. So you have to have some terminology to turn statements about statements into statements about actions or abilities. In one place, I chose, for example, a piece of terminology which was the ability to render a proposition false. So that describes abilities in terms of propositions. So you might say, for example, and we're just concerned with the ability to render true propositions false. So, for example, most of us would think that what's a nice, easy, true proposition? Say, I've got my hands pressed together right now. So that's a true statement that my hands are pressed together, but I can make it false, or so I think anyway. On the other hand, if you say the statement that the moon is spherical, that doesn't seem to be a statement. That's a true statement that I don't have any ability to render false. So one thing that you might need to appreciate the consequence argument is some such piece of terminology as the ability to render a true proposition or statement false. Is that the sort of thing you had in mind?
Yeah, that is. Mm-hmm. Are there any other descriptions of things like that that we need to understand before we can?
Let's suppose not.
Okay.
we could always explain them as we go, I suppose.
I think that's... If any difficulties turn up, well, let's deal with them when they turn up.
Thanks. So you gave a great sort of rough pass gloss of the consequence argument already. Would you like to give a slightly more technical or formal version of the argument now?
I can, although maybe I just a different version of it.
Okay.
So look, you're trying to free will means when you're trying to decide between two courses of action. You can do both of them. Not that you can do each of them, you know, if you're trying to, or let's say maybe it's better to choose the opposite pair of words. You can do each of them. Lying, telling the truth on a given occasion, yeah, you can do each one, but not both. You can't both lie and tell the truth about the same statement. You know, so they're incompatible courses of action, but each one is something that you're able to do. Well, suppose you did the one. Let's say that this time I'll pick you tell the truth. And then what would the world have been like if you had lied? That is, imagine yourself in a different time stream, just diverged from actuality a minute ago. But in that one, you lied. Well, look back at the past from yourself in that other time stream. Either, if determinism is true, then either you're now in a time stream where the past was different from what it was before you made your decision, or the laws of nature are different. And if you say that free will is compatible with determinism, according to the consequence argument, you're saying, I could have got myself into that different path in the world where there are actually the laws of nature are different, or else the past was different. I've always liked a statement by my friend Carl Genet to the effect that our freedom has to be freedom to add to the given past. So at any given time, whatever the future is going to be, no matter what you do, the past is going to be just as it was. So if you can get into a world or a future in which either the past or the laws of nature are different, it's going to have to be a future in which the laws of nature are different. Right? And golly, I don't know if any of you would remember an episode of Star Trek, The Next Generation, where Q has lost his powers, but he's advising the crew of the Enterprise on how to do something, and they ask him what to do, and he's, well, all you have to do is change the universal gravitational constant. how do you expect us to do that? Well, what do you mean, how? You just do it. Data says, I think what they're trying to tell you is that changing the universal gravitational constant is beyond our capabilities. Yeah, it would be beyond anyone's capabilities, because what it is fixed by the laws of nature. And everything in the laws of nature is fixed. So if the past is fixed and the laws of nature are fixed, your choices are narrowed down to what you're actually going to do.
We've talked in a couple of earlier episodes about some other challenges to free will, from logical fatalism, from divine foreknowledge, and the fixity of the past has come up a lot, but we haven't talked about laws of nature, obviously, because we haven't been talking about causal or physical determinism. Is there a way out of the consequence argument that just gives up the fixity of the laws of nature? I'm wondering if you think that's a...
Well, you would just give up determinism. The laws of nature are loose enough they permit more than one possible future. That is, that's what determinism said. Obviously, there are laws of nature, right? Because not just anything can happen. And the moon and the stars continue in their courses. You drop something, leave it unsupported, it will fall, or the surface of the earth anyway. But are the laws of nature so rigid that they lock us down to just one possible future, or do they admit a sheaf of alternative possible futures? If that's so, then the consequence argument continues to show that free will is incompatible with determinism. I mean, if it does show that, I mean, goodness, it's a philosophical argument. It's pretty hard to show anything. But if it does show that, it continues to show that, but determinism is false. So if it's false, it doesn't matter if it's incompatible with free will.
What would you take to be the most plausible response to the consequence argument?
You mean by someone who wants to show that free will and determinism are compatible?
Yeah. Or just to try to show that the consequence argument fails as an argument for incompatibilism.
Well, I think that there are various responses. That there's one by David Lewis that's extraordinarily interesting, but it would be too hard to explain. And there's another by two guys named McKay and Johnson, who showed that a principle that I'd used in one version of the consequence argument, not the one I've just been stating, however, was wrong. But I just despair of trying to describe either of those arguments. It's the kind of thing that probably you would have to be a graduate student in philosophy understand these, and you wouldn't want to get at them orally anyway. You'd want to sit down with the book propped up in front of you and taking notes on them and thinking with a pencil, as we say, So, yeah, I think, there are interesting things that have been said in response to it, but they're really very hard to describe.
Yeah, I think that's fair. We could always link those papers by David Lewis and by McKay and Johnson for those readers, those listeners that are interested. But I think you're right. That would be pretty technical and difficult to get into.
Yeah, my responses to them are available. I could tell you where those are. But, philosophy is just argument without end. There are some knockdown philosophical arguments for some negative conclusions. Maybe say that knowledge isn't just justified true belief, or that formalism isn't the right philosophy of mathematics. But I don't know of any philosophical argument for any positive conclusion that has convinced every philosopher who's capable of understanding and appreciating it. It's an interesting question why philosophy should be that way, but it is.
Yeah.
Thanks. That's very interesting, Peter. In your more recent work, you've talked a little bit about how the term free will gets used or maybe misused, but you still think there is this problem of free will, if we can call it that. There's this problem, you've called it in at least one place, the culpability problem. Is there anything you'd want to say about your more recent work on the problem of free will?
Well, my recent work on the problem of free will is pretty reactive. It's not my central area of philosophical research anymore. If I write something about it, or I think about it, it's usually because somebody has asked me to. The way you guys are asking me on this podcast today, but I've become very disenchanted with the way that the people who will write about the problem, the sort of people who regard themselves as specialists in it today, approach the problem. They seem to me to be the victims of something I call verbal essentialism. That is, they attach inordinate attention to certain words and phrases. And to start with, there's the phrase free will itself. They seem to think that this phrase has some deep meaning that they have to get at. Now, when I was beginning, we just took free will to be a technical term, a term of art. You know, it just meant what we said it meant. And what we said it meant to have free will was that, if you had, looking at it from the future to the past direction, if you did something, you were able to do something else, some alternative action. Or looking at it in the past to future direction, if you're contemplating two future courses of action, it could be that you're able, inconsistent at courses of action, you're able to do both of them. That isn't a very deep idea of free will. There's more to it than that, say the people working on the free will problem today. And that makes no sense to me. Free will is a philosopher's term of art. You can mean anything by it you like, as long as you're clear what you mean. But the problem that I had called the problem of free will, there doesn't seem to be anything much that these people are saying that's even relevant to that problem. And that was the only problem that interested me. And the problem of free will was this. We had the consequence argument, right? It's supposed to show that free will is incompatible with determinism. Well and good. But there are arguments that purport to show that free will is incompatible with indeterminism, right? Or not exactly with indeterminism, because, of course, it wouldn't make any difference to our free will if there was an undetermined electron somewhere in interstellar space. But if our own actions are determined, by the past. That's incompatible with free will, the consequence argument says. But suppose our own actions are undetermined. So suppose you made an important decision, and it was, as the people, as incompatible as believe, if it was free, it must have been undetermined. But wait, though, suppose it was undetermined. That means it might just have gone the other way. If you, here's an argument called the replay argument. You imagine God moving the world back the way it just was before, an instant before you made that supposedly free decision, and then let things go forward once more. Well, gosh, if it was undetermined, it might have gone the other way. And if he did it 1,000 times, sometimes it would go one way, sometimes it would go the other. It looks like it's just a matter of chance what you did on that occasion. And that's what indeterminism looks like to a lot of people. Hmm. And they say, well, then you couldn't have any control over your actions. And that means you can't, if you're trying to decide whether to lie or tell the truth, and it's just a matter of chance whether you lie or tell the truth, then you can't lie. You're not able to lie, and you're not able to tell the truth. In the sense that, I mean, suppose you can throw a dart at a dartboard, and you're able to hit the dartboard, but you can't control it any better than that. Well, then you're not able to hit the right side of the dartboard. Of course, you might throw the dart, and you'll hit the right side of the dartboard, but not because you were able to. So that's the control problem, as some call it. So it seems to some people that free will is incompatible with our actions being undetermined. But they've got to be either determined or undetermined. So if the consequence, we've got this argument, the consequence argument. Sometimes the argument for the incompatibility of free will and our actions being undetermined is called the mind argument, just because it appeared in the philosophical journal Mind so much. Nothing to do with the mind, our mental faculty. Mm-hmm. And if both those arguments are right, then we don't have free will. Well, what's that mean? Well, how can anything be anybody's fault if there's no such thing as being able to do anything else? I mean, suppose you say to somebody says, for example, that they promise you they'll feed your cat while you're on vacation. You come back and you find the cat starved to death. You go to them and say, hey, you promised to feed the cat and you didn't, and now the cat's dead. My cat's dead. That's your fault. And they say, no, it isn't. Why not? Well, I wasn't able to feed your cat. And now you may not believe that, but can you actually say I agree that you weren't able to feed the cat, but it's still your fault the cat is dead. Well, it might, of course, been your fault that you were unable to feed the cat. You might have been drunk the whole time and thus unable to feed the cat, but it was your fault you were unable to feed the cat. But at some point, then you can say, yeah, but it's your fault you were drunk. And you say, no, because I wasn't able to avoid being drunk. Well, if you keep admitting that the person couldn't have done otherwise, wasn't able to do anything else all the way back, then it's hard to see how anything could be anybody's fault. So if there's no, this double ability with respect to the future to be able to do more than one thing, so that a person who didn't feed the cat was able to feed the cat, then it looks like nothing is anybody's fault. Hmm. And what would that mean? What would it mean that the Holocaust wasn't anybody's fault? The Atlantic slave trade wasn't anybody's fault? If a senior member of a department of a philosophy department, say, is jealous of the work of a young member of the department and arranges matters just so that they won't get tenure by, say, spreading false rumors about him with the higher administration, and the guy doesn't get tenure. That's not anybody's fault. Well, it's very hard to believe that. Something's wrong somewhere in this argument.
Yeah.
And probably it's either that the consequence argument has a mistake in it, or that mind argument has a mistake in it, or there's something wrong with that argument for the conclusion you have to have been able to do something else for something to be somebody's fault. The problem of free will, or it might be that maybe nothing is anybody's fault. Maybe the conclusion is right. But that just seems wrong. And it's hard to see what the faults in the other arguments are. So I would say the problem of free will is the problem of either finding the fault in the other arguments or explaining how it can be contrary to everything that seems right and holy to us, that nothing is anybody's fault. That problem is the problem I used to call the problem of free will. Well, they don't want to call the problem of free will that problem anymore. But I don't care what it's called, though. That's why I adopted the term the culpability. It's still the problem that interests me, whether you describe it in terms of the words free will or not. That's certainly... And it's too hard for me. I've given up on it. I mean, I'm inclined to think there's something wrong with the mind argument, but I'm absolutely clueless as to what it is. It looks pretty good to me. Mm-hmm. One philosopher who sort of agrees with me about this, well, linguist philosopher, is Noam Chomsky. He goes the other way. He thinks there has to be something wrong with the consequence argument, but I don't see what it is. And I think it's kind of like this. If you look at the history of philosophy, you would see among the... Well, go back to Zeno and his arguments about motion. My favorite one of those arguments is the so-called arrow argument. Well, actually, nobody knows what the arrow argument is because we only know it through description of Aristotle's, and it's very hard to understand what problem Aristotle was talking about. But it might be something like this. Look at a photograph of an arrow in flight, or since the ancient Greeks didn't have photographs, you could think of them as looking at a painting of an arrow in flight. Well, just look at it, just hanging there in the air, right, motionless. That shows the arrow as it was at an instant. So every instant, the arrow isn't moving. But if something has a property at every instant, then it always has that property. That's what it is, always to have a property. So the arrow is always motionless. But if anything moves, arrows and flight move. So nothing moves. Well, I don't think any ancient Greek was in a position to find out what was wrong with that argument. But I think today we do know what's wrong with that argument because we have conceptual resources the ancient Greeks didn't have. Maybe we're that way with respect to something that's going on in this argument, in this kind of a tetralemma that I've called the problem of free will. There's something, we just don't have the conceptual resources to find out what's wrong with those arguments. That makes me what other people who work on the problem of free will call a mysterian. And if I could return the compliment another direction, I say, better not to have any idea about what's going on in an argument and admit it than to have a wrong idea and think it's a good idea, which is what I think all of them do.
Thanks. That was an excellent presentation of the problem of free will. And as it just so happens, that foreshadows what we're going to do with most of the rest of this first season of the Free Will Show. We're going to talk about the mind argument in some detail in the next episode. We're going to call it the problem of luck. And then we'll go on to talk about challenge to this idea that being to blame or at fault for something really requires having alternative possibilities. We'll talk about K cases named after Harry Frankfurt that call that into question. So yeah, that was excellent. Thanks for going into all that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was certainly, I mean, people who talk about Frankfurt talk about moral responsibility. Mm-hmm. Moral responsibility is one of the terms I've dropped because I think it's been ruined. But I prefer to talk about blame or fault rather than moral responsibility. Mm-hmm. But yeah, as you probably know, my view of Frankfurt's arguments is that even if he does have a counterexample to what is called the principle of alternative possibilities, there are other principles that can get you from no free will to nothing is anyone's fault, even if that one isn't right, and that mm-hmm. the Frankfurt-style examples don't work against the other principles.
Thank you, Peter, for this discussion. It was very interesting and very clear. If listeners are interested in reading some more of your work, where would you direct them to go?
To the site maintained by Andrew Bailey. But I think you can find it just by Googling my last name. Okay. It should come up in one of the top couple of hits in any search engine. And it's got almost all my papers in it, I think. And they're divided up by section. So there's just one section that has papers on free will from the mid-70s to pretty recently, I guess.
All right, yeah. We'll make sure to post a link to that Andrew Bailey's website in the show notes as well.
Yeah, thanks again, Peter. This was awesome. As I mentioned, in our next episode, we're going to talk about the problem of luck. It's often raised as a challenge to incompatibilist views of free will or libertarian views of free will. And our guest for that episode will be Alfred Mealy, the William H. and Lucille T. Workmeister Professor of Philosophy at Florida State University. So stay tuned for that.
Say hello, Al.
All right, we will.